Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome, Weirdos! I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show, and if you're already a member of this weirdo family, please take a moment and invite someone else to listen. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, it's Thriller Thursday, and we return to the Neverglades, possibly the most popular series I've ever narrated here on Weird Darkness. The chapter Lucid Dreams is the seventh entry in the series, and while each story does stand on its own, the characters are the same, and you might want to listen to the first six chapters in order to learn more about who the inspector is, how the characters interact, some of the events that they refer to, etc. I'll place a link in the show notes to take you to all of the preceding chapters, which are numbered, so you'll know the order in which to listen to them. Also, we are collecting these chapters I've narrated and are planning to release them as a full-length audiobook, so the language and imagery in the original book will remain intact for this episode. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. In a small town like Pacific Glade, death isn't always faceless. It hits you especially hard when you're a cop. That body dragged into the coroner's office, that victim slumped and broken behind the lines of police tape, that could be your neighbor or your kid's algebra teacher or that sweet old lady you pass every week at the grocery store. Death doesn't just come for the people on TV. Death slips by you every day, so close you can feel the breeze on your cheeks as it passes and leaves your world a little emptier. Sometimes you notice, sometimes you don't, but it changes you either way. My father-in-law, Peter Lambrecht, died on an early spring morning. He was gray-haired and stooped, but spry for his age, and the carved wooden cane he walked with was mostly for show. He'd brag to anyone who'd listen about how he'd won the stick off a stranger at the Hanging Rock. "Had him sulking in the corner like a raccoon in an empty trash can," he would say. "Never seen the cards hate a man the way they did that day. He was strung up and he knew it. Threw his hand on the table and stormed out, but not before leaving me this beauty." Then he'd show it off by dancing a little jig. He called it his wizard's staff. It was his prized possession, his lucky talisman. But even luck can't stop death when it's barreling towards you at 80 miles an hour. He just stepped outside to grab the paper, leaning sturdily against his lucky staff, plodding through the dewy grass to the mailbox. The morning air was cold, and his joints must have been aching, but he pressed stubbornly onward all the way to the street. The newspaper boy had shoved the thing in deep, and he had to set the cane aside to yank it out. I don't know if he heard the engine getting closer. When he set his mind to something, my dear old father-in-law tended to get lost in his own thoughts, and it wasn't uncommon to see him glaze-eyed and staring off into space. The driver of the car was named Vera Hanscom. She was going fast, way faster than her crappy old minivan was probably built to handle. But there was a wailing baby in the back seat with a spreading rash and two small children who were yelling over each other about God knows what. Poor, harried Vera turned back for just a second to put the kids in their place, but her hand slipped as she did so, and the minivan lurched onto the sidewalk like a drunken man. It was only for a second, but 1 second was all it took. The van struck Peter head-on and sent him flying across the yard. The coroner told me he was dead even before he struck the side of his neighbor's house. Broken back, he'd said, among other things. I didn't need to know the details. All I knew was that there would be no more jigs, no more stories, just glazed eyes forever. Vera knew what she had done, but she panicked and hightailed it away from the scene with her three screaming children in tow. She might have gotten away, too, if another neighbor hadn't seen the whole thing and phoned in her license to the police. In no time, she was surrounded by cruisers, sirens blaring, and lights flashing. The terrified mother left the vehicle with her hands up and tears streaming down her cheeks. They took her and her children down to the station, where Vera wept and shook and confessed to the whole thing, her whole body heaving with sobs. Calls were made. Officers were sent to bring in the body. Everyone was running around trying to keep the situation from getting any worse. It was a big fucking mess. In all the confusion, everyone forgot about the rashy little infant, whose wailing had given way to a soft, pained whimper. In a matter of hours, the baby was dead. Vera didn't even notice until she tried rocking the tiny corpse awake. If she hadn't broken before, that was the crack that split her open. People say her anguished cries could be heard for miles. Karma, some might say. A life for a life. Which is bullshit, of course, because no cosmic force was watching over that road. None that cared, anyway. Death came and death went and left two big holes where it had been. That was it. The story went on. This time it was missing a couple of players. Nico Sanchez was the one who called us at home, and Ruth was the one who answered. I didn't know what they were discussing at first, but I saw Ruth's smile slip, saw her warm persona falter for just a moment, and I knew enough. She composed herself quickly and listened to what Sanchez had to say, but that half-second slip had said it all. And even though I never saw her cry, not even at the funeral, I knew it was taking everything she had to keep herself composed. She did it, though. She smiled at the mourners and told them stories and hugged them close and eased their pain, even when she herself was hurting, because that was Ruth. I was the cop, but she had always been the fighter. The wake was a quiet affair. Peter had been one of those rare souls who had actually moved to the Glade and stayed here. Something about the place seemed to discourage visitors from staying long. But not Peter. He loved the trees, loved the cool summers and the way the sun set so strangely. So he planted himself down, and before long, it was like he'd lived here all his life. The consequence of this was that most of his family lived outside of Pacific Glade, and they apparently had no desire to come here, not even to see him off. Ruth's cousin, Trina, was the only member of the Lambrecht clan to show up on the day of the wake. The rest of the mourners, few as they were neighbors and friends, fellow gladers here to honor one of their own. The Locklear funeral home wasn't extravagant, but Ruth had worked with the family to drape the visitation room in violet banners, Peter's favorite color, and lay out a table of small refreshments. I grabbed a glass of water and eyed the vegetable platter, wondering if it would be distasteful to munch away during my father-in-law's wake. Ruth wandered by me, and I took the opportunity to leave the food and join her by Peter's casket. The dead are just sleeping, I thought, and not for the first time. Ruth's dad looked like he'd simply nodded off for a bit. The coroner had set his limbs straight, given his cheeks a blush he'd never had in life. I've seen plenty of corpses, and after the whole embalming thing, most of them looked like waxy mannequins. Peter looked like he might wake up at any moment. A familiar stick lay with him in the casket. The cane had survived what its owner had not. Whole and unbroken, it now rested under Peter's cold hands. His talisman would go to the grave with him. "Did I ever tell you he took me flying?" I said. "Back when we were engaged, he rented a helicopter somehow and flew us all over the Glade. I had no idea he knew how to pilot one of those things. He'd do all these dips and dives that scared the shit out of me, But every time he would laugh that wheezy, good-natured laugh of his, I knew we weren't in any real danger. I took a sip from my glass. At one point, he even let me take over, and looking down at everything, God, Ruth, it was incredible. It was like being one of the birds. You never really appreciate the trees until you see them from up there. And the lakes and the rivers and the highways cutting through the forest, they looked like one big nervous system, like this huge engine keeping the glade in motion. Puts things in perspective, you know? Ruth didn't look at me. She swished the water in her own glass and stared down at her father's body. "I never knew he flew," she said. "But it doesn't surprise me. Dad always did seem to be reaching for the sky." I kissed her hair and held her close for a moment. She leaned her head against mine and sighed. That was the moment I expected the tears to flow, for all the sadness to come gushing out. But after a few seconds, she gently detached herself and went to talk with her cousin. I listened to her hushed voice, but couldn't make out a word of the conversation. The wake went on for another couple of hours as mourners straggled in and out. I finally gave in and went for the hors d'oeuvres. They had barely been touched, which seemed like a waste to me, and was in the process of biting into a canapé when my son Rory approached, holding a cup of water. He was small for his age, and the suit we'd rented for him looked absurdly big on his tiny shoulders. He picked at his cuffs and stared up at me. It looked like he wanted to say something. "What is it, Rory?" He bit his lip, eyes wide, and I thought a little bit scared. For a second, I thought he wasn't going to speak at all. Then, under his breath, he mumbled, "I saw Grandpa." "I know," I said. "It's not easy to see him lying there like that, but..." Rory shook his head vigorously. "I don't mean in the coffin," he said. "I mean outside." A tiny chill went through me, but I suppressed it. I smiled down at my son and patted his shoulder in what I hoped was a reassuring way. "I'm sure it's nothing," I said, "but why don't you show me anyway?" Rory bit his lip again, but nodded. He led me over to the window by the refreshment table. Placing down his cup, he raised a finger and pointed through the glass. "Grandpa was out there," he muttered, "in the graveyard. He just stood there and stared at me." I leaned closer and peered out the window. Locklear Cemetery was solemn in the dusk light, a sea of jutting tombstones and monuments. The place was deserted. I started to feel a twinge of relief. Rory's overactive imagination was probably getting the better of him again. But then I saw a slight figure standing in the shadow of a tall obelisk. It was too dark to make out much about him, but he appeared to be wearing a pressed black suit, and in his hands he clutched a very distinctive wooden cane. I shot a startled look at Peter's casket. The wizard's staff lay there, as always, held beneath those pale dead hands. When I looked back, the figure in the shadow was gone.
"Did you see him?" Rory asked nervously.
No, I said. "There's someone out there, but it's obviously not Grandpa. Probably just some guy paying his respects to a dead relative." I reached out and ruffled Rory's hair, even though it felt forced to me, and probably Rory, too. He looked unconvinced. A slight frown tugged at his mouth, his eyes still locked on the window. I looked back outside with him. There was no dark figure anymore, and even if there had been, that didn't mean Rory and I had seen a ghost. A lot of old people walked on canes. So what if the guy out there had one that looked an awful lot like Peter's? But this was the Neverglades we were talking about. Weird Shit Central. And I had a bad feeling that whatever we'd seen out there was just the beginning. Two weeks passed without incident, and over time, I gradually forgot about the specter Rory and I had seen. I had my hands full with other cases, nothing weird, for once, just human crimes with human criminals. A man had been killed in his home with a pair of garden shears, and I was pretty sure I knew who'd done it, but I didn't have the evidence to make an arrest yet. 9 o'clock, Thursday night, found me at the Beaver Street Diner, rummaging through stacks of paperwork and trying to spot a thread in this whole tangled mess. I was so wrapped up in my work that at first I didn't notice the faint smell of tobacco entering the diner. It was only when a long shadow fell across the table that I looked up and noticed my visitor standing there. His cigar smoke was a normal shade of gray, and his skin didn't look quite so pallid, but he was still the weirdest-looking patron in the diner by a long mile. "Inspector," I said, "it's been a while." He gestured to the empty booth opposite me with a tilt of his head. "May I sit?" "I suppose." I gathered the papers I'd strewn across the table and stuffed them back into their manila folder. The inspector took a seat with that unsettling grace of his. He wove his hands together and leaned forward, the tip of his cigar glowing. "I know we haven't spoken in quite some time," he said quietly, "and I know you probably have no interest in pleasantries, so I'll cut to the chase. I found a new case, and I'd like your help solving it." A waitress wandered over and asked the inspector if he'd like a cup of coffee, but he waved a vague hand in her direction and she turned back to the counter, looking mildly dazed. I watched her go with an unpleasant clenching in my stomach. "Can you not do that shit?" I muttered. "I still have nightmares about that little freak show you put on behind the rift. I don't need you showing off your fucking god powers." The inspector looked hurt, and for a second I felt guilty. But only for a second. It was hard to feel empathy for a being who was literally bigger than a planet. He sat silently in the other booth, still puffing out that toxic smoke, still staring with those eerie purple eyes. Eventually, he broke the stare and looked out the window into the parking lot. "I understand where you're coming from, Mark," he said, "but I just want to help." "So help then." I drummed my fingers on the folder of case files. "What's this case of yours, and why haven't I heard of it?" "It's not a homicide," he said, turning back to me, "so it wouldn't have found its way to your desk." He reached into his sleeve and withdrew a series of photographs, which he scattered on the table. "In the past several weeks, there have been 8 separate suicides in town. None of them showed any signs of depression before the fact. When I questioned their families, I learned that several of the victims had become obsessed with dead relatives before they killed themselves, poring through photo albums, visiting gravestones, digging up old heirlooms from the attic. 3 days of this obsession, and then death." He began arranging the photos with his slender fingers. "All 8 of them drowned themselves in their bathtubs." I eyed the photos with some hesitation. To my dismay, I recognized a few of the faces. Chester Maines, Nicole Kramer, Veronica Stapleton, Mike Schneider. They were all familiar fixtures around town. Chester managed the supermarket on Brook Street. Nicole was our senior librarian. Veronica led the local Girl Scout troop, and Mike ran the auto shop down in the center of town. I'd just seen him the other month to get my new cruiser checked. He'd been a real pleasant guy, always smiling with a bright laugh and a mouth full of pearly whites. The idea of him killing himself seemed next to impossible. "Okay," I said, taking a deep breath. "Okay, that definitely is on the weird side, but what do you need me for?" "You know this town, Mark," the inspector said. "You know these people better than I ever could. Is there anything that links them together? Any commonality that could help us understand why they might do this?" I examined the line of photographs. All of the faces, even the ones I didn't know, looked like neighbors to me. The pictures were exactly what the news would show when their deaths were reported to the public. Smiling mouths turned to the camera, rosy cheeks, laughter in their eyes. The news didn't want death to be faceless. It's like the newscasters wanted to say, "Look, look at this happiness, because that's all you get. That happiness is dead. Now it's just emptiness, empty rooms, empty hearts, empty homes." "Hang on," I said. "I have an idea." I flipped through my case files and pulled out a map of the Neverglades, which I'd been using to mull over the Garden Shears killer's potential hideouts. I grabbed my pen and marked an X over the supermarket on Brook Street. Then I drew another X over the public library. The inspector watched me work, pensive smoke billowing from his mouth. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Each X marks a place where the victims lived or worked," I said, placing another above Veronica Stapleton's house. If this thing is widespread, then maybe there's a sphere of influence, an epicenter. It could be like the entity in the radio, broadcasting. I don't know, just some kind of suicide wave. Another X over Mike's auto shop. Four marks hardly made a pattern, though, and I struggled to think of what I was missing. Then a thought came to mind. Rory pointing out the window, and a strange figure with a dead man's cane lurking in the shadows of the gravestones. I reached out and scrawled a final X over the Locklear Cemetery. "What happened there?" the inspector asked, frowning. "Dead relatives," I replied. "You said the victims all got obsessed with dead relatives? Well, that's where my son saw my father-in-law up and walking, at his own wake." I looked up at the inspector. "I saw him too." The inspector leaned back in the booth and ran a thumb along the brim of his fedora. "Interesting," he mused. "Perhaps the victims all saw their dead relatives before they..." He didn't finish, but I got the implication. "I'm not feeling particularly suicidal, so don't worry about me," I said. "Let's just see where our epicenter is." I took the pen and drew a rough, wobbly circle through the five X's. Inside the circle was a shapeless mass of trees, and inside them, clear and blue and perfectly round, was Lake Lucid. "The epicenter is Lake Lucid." The inspector shot upright in his seat. "Of course," he said. "Of course, Mark. Do you know the main water supply for those five locations?" "Well, I can't speak for most of them," I said, "but I know the Locklear Funeral Home uses filtered water from the lake. It's barely a mile from the shore." The inspector rose from his seat and began pacing beside the table. A few amused patrons looked over at him, but he either didn't notice them or didn't care. "The water's been contaminated," he muttered. "When consumed, it induces hallucinations, obsession, depression. Enough exposure and the victims drown themselves in it." He stopped and turned to face me. "I think I know exactly what contaminant we're dealing with." "Do you know?" I said. "You know me long enough, Mark," he replied. "Of course I do. Now come on, we must get down to the lake and stop this thing before its influence spreads across the entire glade." He spun around and strode out of the diner, his coat flapping behind him as he walked. I watched him go, and in spite of myself, I smiled. He looked so gung-ho when he caught the scent on a case. He kind of reminded me of me, actually, back when I'd first joined the force, all swagger and confidence and full of the stuff of justice. "He's a monster," my brain whispered. "He could crush you and your family without blinking an eye." But that little warning voice was getting easier to ignore. Monster or not, he was here to help. And deep down, or not so deep down really, I think a part of me had missed the guy. Lake Lucid was dark and starless when the inspector and I arrived. I pulled my cruiser into the parking lot and stepped out into the cool night. The moon was hidden behind a thick layer of clouds, and the surface of the lake had a strange, murky sheen I'd never seen before. We approached the shore and watched the wavelets lap at the sand. "So the suicide wave is coming from somewhere down there," I said. I looked skeptically at the grimy water. "I hate to break it to you, Inspector, but unless you've got scuba gear tucked away in some secret pocket dimension, we may be at a dead end here." The inspector stared thoughtfully at the moonless sky. Thin smoke drifted from the end of his cigar. Then he turned to me and scrutinized my face. I didn't like it. It made me think of a scientist squinting at a disappointing test subject. "Hold still," he said at last. "Wait, what are you..." The inspector removed his cigar and blew a cloud of blue smoke into my face. I coughed and sputtered. The smell was rancid, like rotten fish. Then a searing pain stabbed into my neck, and the breath whooshed out of me in a gasp. Trying to draw in air was suddenly like gulping in a vacuum. I lurched forward and plunged into the lake, my body flailing. I hit the water with a tremendous splash and sank beneath the surface. The lake was cold and murky, and through the cracks of my eyes I could only make out a tangle of weeds and a few darting fish. Water rushed into my mouth, but instead of choking me, it slurped into my lungs with a cool, sated sensation. I clapped a hand to my neck and felt a series of tiny slits that hadn't been there before. They flapped outward with each breath, releasing a stream of bubbles. There was another splash as the inspector dove in after me. He floated in the murk, the tails of his trench coat splayed like a manta ray. He still hadn't let go of that damn cigar. The glowing orange tip somehow refused to go out. "Gills!" I shouted. My voice burbled outward in another stream of bubbles, muted by the water. "You gave me fucking gills? This is exactly the kind of shit I'm talking about. You can't just play God and fuck around with my body like this." "I'll remove them when we're done," the inspector said, a touch defensive. "Besides, it was necessary. You couldn't possibly hold your breath long enough to accomplish what needs to be done here." I gingerly touched the slits in my neck. "A little warning would have been nice," I grumbled. The inspector responded by kicking his legs and swimming further into the lake. "Follow me," he said distantly. "If I'm right, this thing is buried deep. We're going to have to dive all the way to the center." I swiveled in place and swam after him, but I'd fully expected my sodden clothes to slow me down. But whatever the inspector had done to my body had apparently made them waterproof. It had also made me a better swimmer. I slipped through the lake like a human torpedo, my fingers brushing through the strands of underwater plant life and disrupting tiny schools of fish. The inspector clung to the floor of the lake, so I did too. We sent clouds of sand whipping around us as we passed. After a minute or two of swimming, the ground sloped down sharply, and I noticed a dark shape hovering in the gloom just in front of us. "Alligator!" my brain panicked. Before I told it that was stupid, the shape grew clearer as we approached. It had four limbs, a small head, and wasn't moving an inch. And it was wearing a soggy black suit. Panic swept through me again, and this time it didn't subside. I swung my arms around and came to a clumsy halt. "Jesus!" I cried. Bubbles shot in a stream from my mouth. The inspector turned to look at me. "Mark," he said, "what do you see?" His eyes were still a piercing purple, even in the murky water. "It's my father-in-law," I stammered. "His body, I mean, it's just floating there." Peter's corpse was pale and bloated, his open eyes staring off into the clouded lake. I watched as the currents from the inspector's passage spun him slowly in a circle, his wispy hair floating out in all directions. The urge to puke came over me, but I swallowed it down. "There's nothing there," the inspector said, staring past Peter's body. "The lake is making you hallucinate, Mark. It's just the contaminant doing its work." "Yeah," I said. "Yeah, of course." But the body sure as hell looked real, and I was afraid that if I reached out and touched it, my hand would brush against the threads of his decaying clothes. I shimmied past him, keeping my eyes averted, and followed the inspector deeper into the lake. The water was getting colder down here, although it would have been 10 times worse if my clothes had been sopping wet. It became clear that Peter's body wasn't the only one floating in Lake Lucid. The inspector and I passed a second corpse, then a third, then a pair of them who had drifted into one another and gotten tangled. Their faces were pallid, but I recognized them. They were the suicides from the inspector's pictures. I knew they weren't real. I knew I shouldn't look, but I couldn't help myself. Their bodies were so small in death. Even Mike Schneider, the burly auto mechanic, had a drained feeling about him. I kicked my legs and did my best to maneuver past the drowned. Then I recognized other faces. A mangled Edgar Guerrera, the first victim from the Time Eater case. A headless Harvey Jackson. A bullet-riddled Lester Barlow. The pattern was clear. My stomach lurched as I wove my way through a sea of all the people I hadn't saved. They drifted by me, unseeing, waterlogged and empty. A small corpse floated my way, much smaller than the rest. Black strands of hair blotted out his face. The currents moved his body, the hairs shifted, and I found myself staring into the dead face of my son. Rory floated there with all the rest, his mouth open in dull surprise. Behind him, Ruth revolved slowly, and Stephen drifted with his arms spread out like a bird. I started to shake. It wasn't because of the chill in the water. "It's my family," I said dimly. "They're here, Inspector. They're just like all the others."
"You're stronger than that, Mark," the inspector said from up ahead. This time he didn't turn around. "Don't let a shadow scare you. The real danger is up ahead."
I tried to look away, but Ruth's vacant eyes turned in my direction, then frozen in an expression of hurt surprise. I wanted to reach out and grab her hand. Would I lose myself if I did? Would I end up just like my drowned neighbors, consumed by obsessive memories of my loved ones?
"There!" the inspector shouted. "I see it!"
I withdrew my hand, startled. I hadn't realized I had been stretching it out toward Ruth. My fingers curled. This time I managed to tear my eyes away. I twisted my body and kicked away from the illusion of my family, leaving them behind in a cloud of swirling sand. The inspector had stopped a few yards ahead and was now floating in place. I swam over to him. Down on the floor of the lake, in the tangle of floating weeds, a bright salmon-pink shape was pulsing in the sand. It had the curved carapace of a crab, but the sucker was huge, maybe the size of a small horse. Six broad claws extended from its body and drifted lazily through the water. It seemed to be glowing slightly. I peered a little closer and saw that the glow was actually a cloud of neon pink smoke issuing from holes in the creature's shell.
"That's one ugly motherfucker," I said quietly.
"Is it giving off a pheromone or something?"
"Or something," the inspector said. "The dream crab secretes a gas that causes visions and intense mood swings. It likes to squat at the bottom of ponds and lakes until it's tainted the water supply. Then it burrows into the ground and finds a new home."
He frowned.
"It's a stupid creature. I can't fathom how it managed to pass through the rift, unless..."
"Uh-oh," I interrupted. "I think it spotted us." The sand around the crab had started to roil, shooting great dusty clouds out into the water. A ring of beady eyes popped open along the circumference of the shell. I drifted back as a low chittering noise rippled through the lake and sent goosebumps popping up and down my arms.
"Get behind me," the inspector warns. "It's about to..."
One of the pink claws suddenly rocketed forward on a string of sticky sinew, like a ball on a rubber band. The inspector and I leaped aside. I found myself spinning, going head over heels as the ensuing ripple buffeted my body aside. There was a loud snap as the claw closed on the spot where I had just been. I heard the next attack before I saw it. The chittering grew louder, a thrum went through the water, and then the second claw was shooting straight at me. I got my bearings just in time to kick my legs and avoid the ensuing snap. The air around me thickened with that pink smog, blurring my vision and hiding the giant crab from my sight. I floundered for a bit as the claw retreated for round three. This was bad. The water muffled the sound of the creature's movements, and the smog kept me from seeing anything more than 10 feet from my face. The gun on my waist wouldn't do shit underwater, and I wasn't sure how helpful it would be even if I could use it. That carapace looked thick. Bullets might not even leave a dent on that thing. The waters stirred again, sand rising up in a spiral, and I knew the next attack was imminent. I spun around and tried to get my bearings, but there was no sign of the crab anywhere. Nothing but that noxious pink smoke and the awful chittering. I braced myself and tensed my muscles and waited for the creature to strike. But when the smog parted, it wasn't the giant crab I saw. It was the inspector. His coat was splayed out behind him and his lips were locked tight around his cigar. Rearing back, he puffed his cheeks and blew. A storm of purple smoke burst from the tip of the cigar and crashed into the pink cloud. The smog dispersed, turning into little curled wisps, then vanishing. Then the purple tornado swept downward and burrowed into the creature who had been hiding there. The chittering turned to a screech as the smoke coiled up and slipped inside the holes in the shell. I had no idea what was happening underneath, but I'm sure it wasn't pretty. The ring of eyes began to pop, one by one, leaving bloody streaks in the water. The claws flailed for a bit after that, but the fight was gone. Eventually, it slumped on the floor of the lake, gave a final rattle, and went quiet. The purple smoke emerged from the holes and billowed back to the inspector's cigar. I watched as he sucked it all back in, one long, heavy breath. The last of the smoke vanished into its tip, which glowed a brief violet, and then the waters were clear again. I stared down at the crab's unmoving shell.
"Fucking
Christ, I said. Remind me never to piss you off. Is it dead?
I melted its internal organs, the inspector said, you know, as if that was a perfectly ordinary thing to do. He swooped down to the creature's limp body. I tensed up, fully expecting the thing to snap back to life and cleave the inspector in two, but it really did seem to be dead. The inspector pushed aside its corpse with minimal effort and peered down into the sand. He brushed his fingers along the lake bed, a slight frown on his face.
"Hmm," he said, so quietly I'd barely heard him. "Take a look at this, Mark."
I swam over and squinted at the ground beneath him. The inspector had brushed the sand off a circular metal plate, a real high-tech gizmo with circuitry patterns across the front, and a single bulb in the center flashing a low, pale green. Etched above the bulb was a simple red logo. Capra.
"I've seen that before," I muttered. "Where have I seen that?"
"In the forest," the inspector replied. "I found a capsule with this logo near the entrance to the Giant's universe. Strange, isn't it? Two Capra devices. Two ancient creatures that haven't been seen on this side of the rift in millennia."
He went quiet, staring down at the metal disc. "But what is Capra?" I asked. "And what the hell is this stuff doing at the bottom of Lake Lucid?"
"I don't know," the inspector said, "but I think I know where we can start looking for answers."
He lifted the device out of the sand. As he did so, a thick metal wire appeared, trailing down from the lip of the plate and into the lake bed. The inspector gave it a yank, and several feet of taut wire popped up out of the ground. We looked at each other, then off into the deeper reaches of the lake.
"Follow the wire," I said. "Why do I get the feeling this is a seriously bad idea?"
"It may be," the inspector admitted. "Right now, it's the best opportunity we have."
His cigar tip glowed brightly for a second. The light flickered oddly in his eyes.
"Strange things have been happening in this town," he said. "Strange, even for me. But I think the answer to everything lies at the end of this trail."
"Lead the way, then," I said.
The inspector obliged by yanking more wire out of the sand and pulling himself along it, hand over hand. I skirted the giant crab corpse and floated along after him. The fish were scarce down here, probably driven off by the dream crab, or maybe even eaten, so aside from a few straggly weeds, we were alone. There was no sound except the soft rippling of water in our ears. We could have been in another world entirely. The wire led to a pipe, on the smaller side, but large enough for a man to squeeze through if he was so inclined. I had a sinking feeling that was the inspector's plan. He stuck his head into the pipe and peered silently into the darkness.
"It goes on for at least a mile," he said. "The wire follows it all the way."
I sighed. "Fine, I guess we'll go spelunking. But if that thing bottlenecks when we're halfway through, I swear to God..." The inspector ignored me, slipping inside the pipe and out of sight. I reluctantly followed him, chasing the speck of his cigar, which glowed a vivid orange in the otherwise pitch blackness. The water seeping through my mouth had a vaguely sterile taste, and I tried not to dwell on what kinds of chemicals I was ingesting. The pipe didn't bottleneck. As we swam, it sloped upward, the water going from chilly to lukewarm to uncomfortably hot. I was worried it was going to start boiling when a light suddenly appeared in front of us. The pipe widened into a wide-open pool, and the inspector and I finally burst out of the water. I let out a gasp as the gills on my neck flapped shut and sealed back into smooth skin. The inspector was already climbing out of the pool, still following the wire. I clambered after him, shaking the dampness out of my hair. The inspector's hoodoo had kept me from getting soaked, but I still felt a bit waterlogged. At least I wasn't dripping onto the floor. The room we'd emerged in was pretty small, aside from the pool, which stretched from wall to wall. Everything else was a tangle of machinery that looked way too advanced for a dummy like me. The wire wound across the tiles and ended in a console covered with buttons and switches. I drifted closer and saw that there were tiny TV screens embedded in the console.
Most of them showed empty water, but on one I very distinctly saw the dead carapace of the crab the inspector had killed.
Shit, I breathed. They were watching us?
They must have seen us and run for help, the inspector said. Someone was in here not too long ago.
He pointed to a dark puddle on the floor where a coffee mug had fallen and shattered. The puddle was still steaming.
I vote we get the fuck out of here, I said, before they come back.
The inspector swept his eyes around the room, then made a beeline for a plain white door I hadn't seen. We slipped out into a bright hallway with rows of blank doors and a checkered tile floor. Before I could look around too much, I heard the sounds of footsteps approaching from around the corner. The inspector must have heard too. He swept past me and hurried toward another door at the end of the hall. Together we burst through it into a sweeping, open space that looked like a sleek hotel lobby, with huge windows forming a curved wall around us. The inspector and I ducked behind a reception desk, all 7 feet of him somehow squeezing into the tiny space. We huddled there and listened for the approaching footsteps. They got steadily louder. Then a door opened, and the footsteps grew muted. I waited as long as I dared. Then I poked my head over the desk. I could hear voices from some distant room, but otherwise, we were alone. I stood up to get a better look at the space, the inspector rising beside me. The lobby was filled with plush chairs and potted ferns. Through the enormous windows, I saw a long stretch of pavement surrounded by grass and ending in a metal gate. It occurred to me suddenly that we were in a totally unfamiliar and potentially dangerous place with no exit route. I grabbed my cell phone, which had somehow survived a dunk in Lake Lucid, and checked the GPS. Assuming my phone's circuits hadn't gotten scrambled, we were standing in a nameless building on the edge of the lake, a few miles into the Catamount Forest. I dialed Marconi's number and held the phone up to my ear.
Anakin?
She said, picking up on the third ring.
Shh, I whispered. I'm in a tight spot, Marconi, and I need an escape plan. Can you take a cruiser and meet me at these coordinates in 15 minutes?
I told her where we were, and I heard a pencil scratching as she scribbled it down.
Hey, Anakin,
she said suddenly.
It's not like you to run off on a crazy mission without me. Is he with you?
I glanced over at the inspector.
Yeah, there's a whole story here, but I don't have time to tell it now. Just meet me where I told you.
You got it, detective,
she said. Then the phone went silent. I tucked it into my pocket and turned to the inspector.
Come on, I said. We got 15 minutes. Let's figure out what this place is and get the hell out of here.
The inspector lifted a slender finger and pointed to a series of gilded letters on the wall above us. I spun around and backed up a bit. The words were a metallic gold and seemed to glimmer, even though there was no moonlight. Climate Association for the Pacific Regional Area, a subsidiary of Rosen Corp.
Climate Association? I said. Why do I get the feeling that's a front for something much more sinister?
Because it probably is, the inspector said. Come on, let's go further in.
We snuck through the lobby and down a nondescript hallway. Door after door stretched out as far as I could see. I tried the first one, but it was locked, of course. The inspector stepped forward and made a clicking sound with his teeth. Something inside the lock imitated the sound, and the door cracked open.
You're just full of surprises, aren't you? I said.
The room inside was your standard laboratory fare. Although it was dark, and I couldn't make out much, except a few spindly microscopes. The next room was largely the same. And the next, and the next, and for a minute I thought we wouldn't find anything remotely incriminating. Then I opened one door and found myself staring at a storage room full of wooden boxes. Stamped across each of them were the words, CAUTION, EXPLOSIVES.
Well, the inspector said, that's a bit concerning.
You're telling me, I muttered.
I closed the door. We pressed onward, creeping through corridor after corridor, passing more locked doors and the occasional bit of wall decoration, mainly landscape portraits and pictures of nameless figures in lab coats. At one point we passed an aquarium filled with lazily drifting rainbow fish. A few corners past the aquarium, the hall ended in a set of imposing double doors marked with yellow warning signs that practically shouted employees only. I drew closer to them cautiously. The inspector drifted ahead of me and lifted a hand up to the glass window. A loud sound ripped through the air. I can only describe it as a vorp, and the inspector was suddenly blasted forward. The projectile singed my cheeks as it whooshed by. I clapped a hand to the searing skin, wincing. A thought flitted into my head. That's gonna leave a mark. But right then I had more pressing concerns than a little burn. I watched helplessly as the inspector's body flew through the air, struck the double doors, and exploded into a thousand tiny purple particles. "No!" I screamed. The air crackled behind me, and I turned to see a very large and very deadly-looking weapon held inches from my temple. It was a gun straight out of some sci-fi flick, with a long chrome barrel and a yellow orb at the tip that sparked with bursts of electricity. The woman holding it looked about my age, although her cheeks were lined with premature wrinkles. She wore glasses, a white lab coat, and had a mane of long blonde hair tied back into a ponytail. A single golden hair curled across her forehead like a question mark. About a dozen men in armored black suits and faceless masks stood behind her, holding assault rifles that looked far less sci-fi but no less deadly.
"I suggest you come with me," the woman said in a husky voice. "Our tall friend will probably piece himself together again, but something tells me you won't be as successful unscrambling your atoms."
Her finger tightened on the trigger, and the crackling intensified.
"Drop your weapon and put your hands behind your head."
I bent over cautiously and placed my pistol on the tiles. What choice did I have? I straightened up, hands raised, and rested my palms on the back of my head. One of the masked men hurried forward and snatched the gun from the ground. After a few tense seconds, the woman lowered her weapon a fraction.
"Turn around and walk through those doors," she said. "Do exactly as I tell you, and your safety is guaranteed. If you try to escape or do anything else funny, I won't hesitate to fire this thing. Do I make myself clear?"
"Clear as crystal," I muttered. My burnt cheek throbbed as she nudged me forward with the tip of her gun. Hands still behind my head, I walked as slowly as I dared toward the set of double doors. Each footstep clacked on the tiles like panes of breaking glass. I reached the doors and pushed through them with my shoulder, emerging in a dimly lit hall lined with windowless doors.
"Third door on the right," the woman said. "Step inside and don't move a muscle. I'll be right behind you the entire time."
I did as she said and approached the door. The yellow warning sign plastered across it did little to ease my already churning stomach. I turned the handle, pushed it open, and walked inside. Fluorescent lights in the ceiling flickered on as I entered. Despite the ominous sign out front, the room looked like another fairly nondescript science lab, complete with beakers and microscopes and an equation-riddled whiteboard. A large circle shape in the corner sat hidden under a gray blanket.
"You two stand guard out here," I heard the woman say. "The rest of you, spread out. If there are any more intruders around here, they won't get far."
There was a shuffle as the masked man did what he instructed, and then the woman was in the room with me, closing the door behind her. The only sound was the crackle of her laser gun. She kept it trained on me as she circled around the room, her eyes sharp and blue behind her thin glasses. Neither of us spoke for several seconds. Then her shoulders relaxed and she let out a breathy laugh. I didn't move, not even when she powered down the gun, placed it on the counter, and approached me with an outstretched hand. Every muscle in my body sensed a trap.
"Sorry for all the theatrics, but we can't be too careful," she said. "I know who you are, Detective Hannigan. I've heard all about you. It's a thrill to finally meet you face to face."
She gestured for me to take her hand and smiled.
"I'm Valentina Koppel. I run this facility."
I didn't shake her hand, but I did lower my arms. Her smile was earnest, and her eyes had softened, but just seconds ago she'd had me at blaster point, so pardon me if I had fucking trust issues.
"Theatrics?" I echoed at last. "You blew up my friend. You call that theatrics?"
Valentina's fingers curled up.
"He'll be fine," she said. "The inspector's a big boy. It'll take more than an atom blaster to keep him down for long."
She turned around, strode to a lab tool, and took a seat, her legs crossed.
"Which is why we don't have much time to talk."
"I'm not sure what you think I have to say to you," I said. "Jesus Christ, you blew him up! Don't you get that? I don't care if he'll glue himself back together. What makes you think I'm going to get all buddy-buddy with someone who blows up my friends?
I needed to speak to you, she said with an infuriating calmness, and there was no chance of that happening with him around. So I removed him, temporarily. You're blowing this way out of proportion.
Am I? I said. I took a step toward her. Why don't you tell that to the 8 people who just killed themselves because of the contaminated lake water? Or those campers who got their juices sucked out by the Wendigo? Because both of those scenarios had your ugly stamp on them. Kind of hard to fake innocent when you leave behind a fucking calling card.
Valentina was quiet, and for a second, I thought I had stumped her. But she simply uncrossed her legs and sighed, as if she was disappointed in me.
Why would I want to fake innocent? She said. I'm proud of what we've accomplished in Pacific Glade. Did you know we were the first humans on the entire planet to find tangible evidence of another world? Even better, the first to make contact with life on the other side. It's not always intelligent, and it's not always benevolent, but we learn more with every experiment. Soon we may even be able to cross through the rift ourselves.
You don't want to do that, I blurted before I could stop myself.
Valentina raised an eyebrow. The smile that had dimmed returned, this time a fraction wider. She reached into the pocket of her lab coat and withdrew a tiny tablet computer, her fingernails clacking furiously as she began to type.
Of course, she said. I forgot you'd been behind the rift, detective. What was it like? Was it populated? Was there a world like ours, or was the environment utterly alien? Tell me as much as you remember.
It was purple, I said. Everything was the same except purple.
Wait, why am I telling you this anyway? I don't have to tell you anything.
Valentina looked up from her tablet.
Of course you don't, she said, but I think you will. We have a lot to learn from each other, detective, and it would be in your best interest to think of me as an ally. I can offer you resources, information, weapons, technology that would aid you in your investigations.
My investigations? I said. A skeptical laugh escaped from my mouth.
You mean the investigations you were responsible for? There wouldn't have been any cases to look into if you or your corporate goons hadn't invited monsters to town.
Valentina frowned. You don't think we brought them all here, do you? Reality is thin in the Glade. Sometimes things get through, and sometimes we deal with them. Other times we welcome them in and try to learn from them. Everything we do is in the pursuit of knowledge and understanding.
I fail to see how killing a whole bunch of civilians fits into this mission statement of yours, I said.
She pursed her lips and crossed her legs again.
The collateral damage was regrettable, she said. But any scientific advances of this scale require some sacrifice. We learned a great deal from the entity in the radio waves before it went haywire. It told us about the empathic giants and how they could naturally cross between dimensions. It told us how to channel the power of the rift to enhance human ability. Most of the test subjects didn't last, but we achieved tremendous success with one, Marcy McKenna. I believe you knew her?
I have no idea who you're talking about, I said.
Valentina looked surprised, then laughed.
No, I suppose you wouldn't.
What the hell are you even trying to accomplish here? I asked.
Whatever's behind that rift isn't interested in making friends. They're cruel and hungry and think we're like insects. Best case scenario, they kill you fast. Better than having your body hijacked or your life force slowly sucked out through your brain.
But don't you see, detective, she said. Making friends is exactly what you've done. She leaned forward, something glinting in her eyes.
How else would you describe this rapport you've formed with the inspector?
I faltered. I hated to admit it, but she actually had a point there. She balanced on the edge of her stool, shoes dangling idly above the tiles.
The inspector's an exception, I said at last.
He's the missing link, she said. The bridge between us and that world. If we can work with him, there's no limit to the things we can learn.
Her excitement was growing, her eyes lighting up.
Just think of what we could accomplish with a being like that on our side.
You don't know anything about him, I said. He's never going to help you, not after what you've done.
Valentina settled back against the counter.
No, she said, probably not. which is why we need you, Detective Hannigan. Come again?
Observe him, she said. Share his knowledge with us. Tell us about his powers and his weaknesses. Learn what you can about him and the world he comes from. No piece of information is too small or too insignificant.
I'm not being your fucking double agent, I spat.
This isn't about loyalty, she said, frowning. This is about what's best for this town, for the entire human race.
What's best for this town? I echoed. What an absolute crock of shit. Was it good for the town when your radio monster melted people's brains? How about those people who killed themselves because you placed a hallucinatory monster at the bottom of the lake? Those were my neighbors, my friends. They didn't deserve what they got.
I took in a shaky breath and clenched my fists. You're putting the entire glade in danger, and for what? Science? This isn't sacrifice, it's a slaughter.
The problem, she said calmly, is that you're not seeing the larger picture here. Our research is not theoretical. We know the rift is dangerous, and we know that one day, maybe tomorrow, maybe in a month, maybe in 1,000 years, something will come through that threatens everything we've ever known. And when that day comes, we must be prepared.
She peered at me above the rim of her glasses.
Sometimes lives get lost in the name of progress. This is nothing new. I thought you, as a cop, would understand that.
I was silent for a moment. A clock ticked somewhere in the background. The masked guards shuffled their feet outside the door. I mulled over her words and stared at the blanket-covered object in the corner.
Yeah, I've killed people as a cop, I said quietly, but it's a tragedy every time.
It's a family missing a father or a mother or a child. It's someone's story coming to an end. And even if it's necessary, even if it means saving my life or the lives of the people around me, it still hurts. They all mean something to me. They're not just data on some spreadsheet.
Valentina said nothing. She sat utterly still on the lab stool, looking at me as if she'd never seen anything stranger in her entire life.
If you don't help us, she said, we'll have to continue observing the inspector from afar. And that means more monsters, more pointless deaths, more tragedy. Will you be able to live with yourself, knowing that on some level all that blood is on your hands?
I gritted my teeth.
You bitch, I growled. Don't try to twist this around and blame this shit on me.
I stopped. The room had suddenly started to rumble, like a train was going by on the other side of the wall. I reached out and gripped the closest counter. Valentina looked up at the ceiling, alarmed, as little flecks of plaster came loose and sprinkled around her like snowflakes.
God damn it, she muttered. I thought we'd have more time.
The air in the center of the room suddenly contracted, warping the tables and chairs and creating a loud sucking sound. Bits of purple goo spat out of the center of the contraction and floated in the air like they'd struck an invisible wall. Valentina and I watched as the gunk condensed on itself, growing mass, becoming long and thin and sprouting outstretched limbs. My heart leapt as the goo molded into a trench coat and a wide-brimmed fedora, still purple and dripping, but unmistakable. Valentina's eyes were fixed on the newly reforming inspector. I took advantage of the distraction to run forward and snatch her blaster from its spot on the counter. Valentina jumped and fumbled for the gun, but I darted backward out of reach, training the barrel at her chest. I flicked a switch on the side, and the tip began to crackle with yellow lightning.
Make a move, I breathed. I fucking dare you.
She froze in place and stared at me. She didn't look scared or angry, just curious, as if she wanted to see what I'd do. I tightened my grip on the handle and glanced at the blob that was the inspector. He'd started to shed the blanket of purple goo, gray skin exposed on his face and hands. His feet touched down on the floor of the lab. His coat dripped in violet puddles on the tiles as he turned his head and stared at Valentina. His cigar was back, and curls of hot red smoke issued from his mouth.
Inspector, I said, you made it back in one piece.
The tall figure said nothing, did nothing, only stared at Valentina with rage burning quietly in his eyes. I didn't like her in the slightest, but I didn't exactly want the inspector to splatter her guts across the walls, or whatever else he was capable of. I cleared my throat.
We gotta go, I said. Leave her for now. We can deal with her later.
The inspector didn't speak, but he nodded slowly. Good enough. I figured we would probably muscle past the guards if necessary, but I had a fucking laser gun in my hands, and it would be a waste not to use it. I turned the barrel to the door and tightened my finger around the trigger. The device let out a low hum, like a nest of cicadas, before letting out another ear-splitting vorp and unleashing a blast of light. The door utterly disintegrated, leaving behind a jagged, circular hole. Through it, I saw the two guards slumped on the floor, having been blasted into the far wall. They looked burnt and unconscious, but otherwise alive. "Come on," I said, scrambling through the hole. We didn't exactly have the element of surprise, but we did have an atom blaster, so I guess it sort of balanced out. The inspector glided past me and made a beeline for the double doors. I followed him, but not before shooting a glance back at Valentina. She was still perched on her stool, although she had her tablet in her hand, and I was sure she'd already called for backup. Her eyes locked on mine. This whole meeting clearly hadn't gone as she'd intended, but even so, she didn't look upset or even disappointed. It looked like she was thinking, like she was already calculating what the next move would be. I didn't like that look, so I turned away and ran after the inspectors retreating back, even as the halls lit up with red alarms, even as sirens began to blare like foghorns in my eardrums. It was only a matter of time before the guards in black would be on us. But I had this big fucking gun, and I had the inspector. Maybe that would be just enough to make it through the onslaught unscathed. I just hoped Marconi was waiting for us on the outside. The first wave of guards hit us right as we were passing the aquarium. They came pouring out of hidden doorways, visors pulled low, lethal-looking rifles clutched in their hands. One of them barked a command to stop, but the inspector didn't even hesitate. He ripped the cigar from his lips and flicked it at the glass. The tip flared briefly, then exploded. Water came gushing through the hole along with a deluge of brightly colored fish. The guards were knocked off their feet and swept down the length of hallway, swearing as they did so. The water rushed toward us, but instead of knocking us over too, it broke into two waves and missed us completely. The inspector stood impassively between the walls of water. As I watched, the cigar shot back to him like a boomerang and planted itself firmly in his mouth. "Nice trick, Moses," I said. "Now let's get the fuck out of here." We hurried through the halls, ducking around the corner as another set of guards rushed past. My fingers itched on the atom blaster, but I was reluctant to actually fire the thing at a human being. Plus, there was no guarantee it was even powered up after that last discharge. The orb at the tip was still crackling, but I thought the sound was a bit dimmer than it had been before. The inspector lifted his hand and beckoned for me to follow him. We moved through the halls as fast as we dared. At one point, we ran past a large set of glass doors, and I skidded to a halt, staring at what lay behind them. The doors were bolted shut, but they led outside. A small stretch of ground jutted from the threshold and ended in a helipad. Sitting pretty on the pavement was a sleek, black helicopter. "Inspector!" I hissed, stopping him. "Look! My father-in-law taught me to fly those things. It was ages ago, but still, I could probably pilot that baby out of here." The inspector looked outside and frowned. The smoke gushing from his cigar was an alarming shade of yellow.
"Sheriff Marconi's waiting for us," he rasped. Maybe his vocal cords hadn't fully reformed yet. "If we take another route of escape, they'll find her. Don't forget that she's been beyond the rift, too. She's just as valuable to them as you are."
I hesitated, but not for long. The inspector was right. I hefted the blaster and hurried past the glass doors, leaving the helipad behind. The lobby was miraculously empty, but when we burst through the front doors and dashed out onto the pavement, we found ourselves suddenly faced with a squad of armed men. I skidded to a halt and whirled around, but now the lobby was swarming with guards. They spilled through the doors and surrounded us on all sides. I felt my heart sink as I whipped the blaster back and forth. I could probably take out a swath of them, but there were too many to handle with just one weapon, and it would only take one well-placed bullet to drop me.
"Place the gun down and put your hands up!" barked one of the masked men.
"Enough of this," the inspector muttered.
He raised his hands, palms up, and clenched his fists. At once, the ground erupted.
A solid column of dirt and grass shot from the cracks in the pavement and barreled into the first line of guards, sending them flying. The rest of them immediately opened fire on the inspector. I threw myself on the ground as bullets whizzed over my head and sank into the inspector's body like putty. Unmoved and unhurt, he swung his arms to the right and took out another dozen men with a second column of earth. They cried out in pain and surprise. I watched as they flew through the air and struck the ground, moaning.
"Now, Mark!" the inspector shouted.
Startled, I got clumsily to my feet and swung the blaster toward the facility gate. Only two guards were left standing, but they peeled when they saw the weapon in my hands. I thumbed the switch on the side and set the tip a crackle with yellow lightning.
"Move, or I'll blast you!" I said shakily. "I'm not gonna ask twice!"
I tightened my finger on the trigger. The weapon's hum grew louder, and the guards, deciding they wanted to live another day, threw themselves aside. The blast escaped from the gun and slammed into the gate, disintegrating it on impact. The inspector strode forward at once. He glided through the gaping hole, dirt and pebbles still swirling around his feet. I gripped a smoking gun and hurried after him. The inspector sped up once we were past the gate, and I quickened my pace as well, shooting a nervous glance behind me. It wouldn't take long for the guards to get back on their feet and come after us. We had a head start, but they had more men and more guns. Our escape hinged entirely on Marconi. We raced down a crude stretch of pavement into the heart of the forest. My heart was pounding, and I cursed myself for not staying in better shape. Just when I thought I couldn't run any further, the rumble of an engine rose suddenly from the forest, and a police cruiser with dark headlights appeared. The car skidded to a halt in front of us and kicked up a cloud of dirt.
"Get in!" Marconi shouted.
The inspector and I leaped into the back seat and swung the door shut, just as bullets zoomed through the trees and shattered the window. A few more bullets thunked into the side of the cruiser, but Marconi was already peeling rubber in the other direction, headlights glaring. I clutched my seat as we rocketed down the road. The car rumbled like a washing machine as it drove over the uneven gravel.
"Jesus, Hannigan!" Marconi called back to me. "How do you always get yourself into the deepest shit?"
I didn't answer. I could hear shouting and a few more bursts of gunfire, but for now it sounded like we were gaining distance. Then I remembered the helicopter, and I turned my eyes to the night sky, squinting for any black shape hidden in all that darkness. If they were following us by air, they were well hidden. I couldn't see anything in the sky except a few stars struggling to poke through the dense layer of clouds.
"Let's get back into town," I said finally. "They don't want us getting away, but I have a feeling they won't follow us into the glade. A bunch of civilians getting an eyeful of their masked army would totally blow their cover."
"I'm real curious as to who they are and why they want to put a bullet in you two so bad," Marconi said. "Get talking, Hannigan."
So I walked through what we had seen in the facility and what Valentina Koppel had told me. Marconi listened without saying a word. The inspector didn't seem to hear a thing I was saying. His eyes were turned toward the shattered window, lost and distracted. I peered through the hole with him. In the distance, I thought I saw a long, bungalow-type structure partially hidden by the trees. Was that Capra headquarters? I stared at the low shape and wondered what kind of strange science was going on inside. I knew so little about the organization or what it was really after. Valentina had said an awful lot in that lab room, but in the end, she hadn't told me much at all. It was well past midnight when I finally got home, but a light was still on in one of the downstairs windows, and I opened the front door with some apprehension. Valentina beat me here, I thought, absurdly. But as I crossed the kitchen quietly and peered into the den, I saw Rory curled up on the couch reading a comic book by lamplight.
"Hey, sport," I said.
Rory jumped and almost dropped the comic. His eyes were bleary, I noticed, like he'd been fighting sleep until I came home. I sat down next to him and patted him on the knee.
"What you doing up?" I asked. "You're going to be hurting at school tomorrow if you don't go to bed."
Rory was quiet for a moment. Then he put aside his comic book and said,
"I couldn't sleep. I keep thinking about Grandpa."
I'd been so preoccupied by psychic crabs and shadowy organizations that I'd almost forgot where this whole investigation had begun. Rory didn't just look weary from the sleep. He looked world-weary.
was a strange expression to see on a 12-year-old. "If you're worried about what we saw at Grandpa's funeral," I said, "you don't have to be. I have a feeling we're done seeing ghosts around here." But Rory shook his head.
"I'm not worried about that," he said, like the idea was stupid. "I just keep thinking about the last time I saw him. Came over on Easter and told us stories about when he was growing up, you know, outside the glade. They were really good stories, and it's dumb, but..."
He stopped and sniffed a little.
"I want to hear more of his stories, but I know I can't. And I keep thinking, like, I knew him, but I didn't really know him, you know? And now I won't ever know him. Not really."
I pulled Rory into a tight hug. He let out one tiny sob, but was otherwise quiet. I held him close and patted his back and thought about what I had told Valentina. Every death was a story ending, a book being closed for good. Rory understood that now, in ways Valentina and her scientists never could. We stayed up for another hour or so, curled up on the couch, sharing stories about Peter and what we remembered of him. Eventually, Rory's eyes drooped, and I laid his head gently on the cushion. Then I shuffled upstairs, opened my bedroom door, and slid under the covers. Ruth's hand closed around mine. I nestled up against her, comforted by her warmth, by her steady presence, and together we slipped into sleep. Every life is a story, and we never know how many pages are left in ours. So we bookmark moments to come back to. That night with Rory, that moment of closeness of Ruth, those were some of my bookmarks. And when the pages finally ran out, when my story reached its peak, those were the moments I clung to.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. You can email me anytime with your questions or comments at darren@weirddarkness.com. Darren is D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and the show's Weirdos Facebook group on the contact social page at weirddarkness.com. Also on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story or call the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. Stories on Thriller Thursday episodes are works of fiction, and links to the stories or the authors can be found in the show notes. Lucid Dreams was written by David Farrow, and it's part of the Neverglades Mysteries series, which I have placed a link to in the show notes, along with several links to follow the author on social media. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions, trademark Weird Darkness 2021. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Proverbs 13, verse 10. Pride only breeds quarrels, but wisdom is found in those who take advice. And a final thought, common sense is not a gift, it's a punishment, because you have to deal with everyone who doesn't have it. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.
Want to receive the commercial-free version of Weird Darkness every day? For just $5 per month, you can become a patron at WeirdDarkness.com. As a patron, you get commercial-free episodes of Weird Darkness every day, bonus audio, and you also receive chapters of audiobooks as I narrate them, even before the authors and publishers hear them. But more than that, as a patron, you're also helping to reach people who are desperately hurting with depression and anxiety. You get the benefits of being a patron, and you also benefit others who are hurting at the same time. Become a patron at WeirdDarkness.com.